Today is December 9th, 2006, and this is the Weekly Roundup. It's the 55th Weekly Roundup, but it's the first Apple Weekly Report. It is still a Mac Observer podcast, and for better or worse, I am still Ricky Spiro.
And whether you like it or not, I'm still Jeff Gamet. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/roundup.
Okay, wait a minute. We got to stop right here. You're probably wondering why it is that Jeff and I sound like we're in a sewer as we record this show. It's my fault. I listened to the reverb just to have a better idea what's going on as I'm mixing the show or as I'm recording the show. And I accidentally printed it to the show, so you all have to listen to it this week. I apologize. I'll fix it next week. I hope you enjoy the show. This is the year in review. We've got a kind of different thing going on here. This is the Apple Weekly Report now. We figured, hey, we're 1 year into the show. It was December 9th, 2005 that we released the first episode of the Roundup. And we're 1 year into the show now. Jeff has gone and outdone himself, created a new logo for the show. And we figured, hey, what better opportunity to sit back and play pundit on the entire past year of Mac news, iPod news, than this show, since it is the one-year anniversary of the show and near the end of the calendar year as well. We were actually going to have Brian Chaffin, the editor at TMO, join us for this show, but he's apparently getting married today. So
Brian will go to any length to get out of doing a podcast, apparently.
Yeah, seriously. So I don't know what that's about, but, you know, best of luck to him, and, you know, everyone has their priorities in life. I guess sometimes you can't make a podcast because you got to get married.
There you go.
But hey, it's going to be the same show it's always been. Context, Mac news with no fanaticism, iPod news without the hype, same thing we always say. We're just going to get into it. And this should be a fun show looking at some of the big stories from the past year. All right, let's start off with the big story this year, the overarching story of the year when it comes to platform news that we talk about here on the show. Earlier this year, I asked in one of our show descriptions, what's worth $112 billion, employs about 100,000 people, earned a paltry $1.5 billion in the last 3 months, and manufactures the perfect complement to guacamole. Those would be chips. The move to Intel is certainly the big story of the year, with the most overarching impact on the stuff that Mac users and even to a certain degree iPod users are going to experience. Jeff, tell us, why is the move to Intel a big deal?
Wait, did I miss something? Apple moved to Intel? What?
What's going on?
Oh, no. So actually, the amazing thing for Apple out of this whole transition, I mean, other than the fact that they did it way ahead of schedule, is the fact that they opened up doors that were closed before. So they have all kinds of opportunities for hardware that weren't there before. For instance, if at some point Intel totally jacks over the processors that Apple needs, they can go look to another company like AMD. So they're not tied in like they were before to the whole Motorola Freescale thing. They have a lot more flexibility. And it looks like we also have processor technology that has a lot of room to grow now. So hooray for Apple and hooray for us, because we're getting powerful, faster machines.
Now, in addition to powerful, more faster, good machines, change the show name and all of a sudden I can't speak. There's also, and you kind of alluded to this, there's also a much faster turnaround. There's a much faster upgrade cycle going on with Intel than there had been with Freescale, IBM, Motorola. One of the aspects of that turnaround time, of that faster upgrade cycle, The Intel transition has gotten Apple to move to 64-bit, with the exception of the Mac Mini. But all of their products, all of their other Mac products, are now 64-bit products. And we had a show description a little while ago about how Apple had very quietly upgraded the iMac to the Core 2 Duo. They didn't make a big deal out of it, but they moved it from a 32-bit to a 64-bit architecture. The MacBooks came shortly after that. Give us a remind us. We did a show on this again a while ago, but why does it matter that we've moved to 64-bit?
The big thing about 64-bit is that now we have processors that can count higher, which means that we can use larger amounts of memory at one time. We can get more. That's what it comes down to. We were hitting a limit with the 32-bit processors as far as how much memory and that we could get and a few other things. But the big thing is the 64-bit processors take us to the next level. So now we can really start growing the computers again, and we'll start seeing the big jumps. Well, we already have to a degree, that we saw when computers were able to go beyond the, you know, like when we had 8-bit processors. There wasn't a lot of memory we could access. We couldn't hold as many active programs at one time, and not even taking into account the technology at the time. You couldn't run more than one program at once. But we can do so much more now than we could before, and that's thanks to the 64-bit processors. They give us that big roadmap to the future.
There's also, and we talked about this a little bit in that roundup that we did on 64-bit technology, one of the other elements here is that there's so much, and actually John Braun and Dave Hamilton on the Mac Geek app did a terrific job going into some of the nitty-gritty details and how 64-bit on some of these machines is not really 64-bit, and there are some weird quirks with the way the technology is implemented. But conceptually, there's a lot of stuff. In addition to the processor design, there are a lot of levels above that that affect performance and affect how we experience our computers. The operating system incorporates several of those levels, things with names like the kernel and BIOS and APIs. Those things, that software is being rewritten currently to be fully 64-bit, and our understanding, what we've been told by Apple at the Worldwide Developers Conference, is that Leopard OS 10.5 is going to be fully 64-bit, and that, just as a concept, having an entirely 64-bit product line and a 64-bit operating system, that puts Apple in a very different position from the PC manufacturers, who have to say, well, you can buy our 64-bit machines, and then you need to buy the 64-bit version of Windows, and it's a whole big mess. This puts Apple in a very, very different category in terms of marketing and its position in the marketplace.
Absolutely. And since Apple has been doing their quiet ramp up into the Core 2 Duo processors, what we'll have when Leopard comes out is a $129 processor upgrade for every computer that's using those chips. It's going to be like hitting the turbo button, really.
Right on. Now, there's one other aspect of this Intel transition that developed midway through this past year. There was all this discussion when the Intel machines started to come out about running Windows on a Mac. Now, I claim, and I'm curious what you think about this, Jeff, that one of the reasons the move to Intel is a big deal, not just from the computer user's perspective, but again, from an industry perspective, is boot camp. And what I said in the show description, with Apple now taking the lead, Windows XP on the Mac is moving from a hack, that was this homegrown grassroots project to get Windows XP to run on a Mac, it's moving from a hack to a reality. And John Braun joined me on the show, and we talked a little bit about the details of how one goes about using boot camp and how easy it is and who it might appeal to. We understand that midway through next year, when OS 10.5 comes out, boot camp is going to be built in to the operating system. So this is really interesting to me. How is this a big deal? Setting aside the users for the moment, who may or may not find it useful to use Windows on a Mac, what's the impact in the industry of Apple being able to say, hey, you can run Windows on a Mac if you want to?
Well, do you remember the Get a Mac commercial with the I'm a Mac, I'm a PC guy, where they talked about boot camp? The Mac character said, well, you know, you can run OS X, you can run Windows on me, I'm really the only computer you ever need. And that's what it comes down to. You're going to see a lot of companies that, assuming Apple provides the right sort of corporate support that they need to have, you're going to have companies that look at this one computer platform and say, I can run anything on it. Okay, sign me up. And there are a lot of companies that would like to go with Apple hardware because of the quality that you get out of the products Apple makes. But of course, they've always had to hold off because you couldn't run Windows and all of the assorted applications that go along with that. That changes now. And once that's built into Leopard, so you don't have to go through and do this whole extra installation and the on-the-fly reformatting and all that, it's just out of the box, ready to go.
In my other career, my other life, I work with a lot of academic computer scientists who are writing a lot of software, and I was sitting in a meeting the other day, and one of them had his new MacBook sitting on his lap, and he was saying something about how, next to people were complaining about whether the certain machine would work with the projector where someone was giving a talk. And he said, well, next time I'll just come in and I'll give my talk in Windows on my Mac, and that'll shut everybody up. It's interesting to me that people, there was a round of this when OS X originally came out, and people said, hey, now there's command line in OS X. We can take it more seriously as an operating system.
Which is crazy.
I feel like there's now another cycle of that where, and an additional cycle of that where people say, well, now we've got the consumer operating system, Mac OS X, we've got the command line if you really want to do that, and now we have the option of running Windows XP. The perception of the operating system changes dramatically when you say, hey, look, we can do Windows too if we have to.
Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of people that are really excited about where this is all going, and I'm one of them.
All right. Now, the other big story this year, it was not a specific story, but it was a general story, a kind of general trend in news. The politics of tech, I feel, really blossomed this year. There was a lot of tech politics out there in the news. For example, from one of our shows, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to ban most kinds of internet gambling. And TMO's editor, Brian Chaffin, getting married today. Huzzah. And I got into the politics of it all. And Brian came on and argued, you know, this is red meat for the religious right. And I was saying, well, what about some of the left consumer organizations? There's Ralph Nader's former or Ralph Nader's brainchild, a public policy, public activism group, was also supporting this legislation. Fascinating subject for anyone, poker players, politics junkies, anyone who's into tech or just likes, you know, a good fight. Really interesting discussion. Now, that didn't go anywhere, that particular bill, but it's kind of indicative of the way tech gets discussed in the news. I'm curious, Jeff, for your reaction, just watching the news day to day, what's your impression of the way technology gets treated in the political sphere?
I shake my head in disbelief. No, I really, I do.
All right.
When I watch or listen to a lot of the news reports that relate to technology in some way, well, first you have to keep in mind, most of the people that are going to be providing the news coverage on these issues don't understand at all what the technology is or what the underlying ramifications of the issues are. You know, the people that are talking about this, they're reporters, they're talking heads, they're doing their job. They don't understand the rest of this. And so they will add in their own perspective, which is sometimes naive, sometimes it's right on, but a lot of times they're just way off base with what they're saying. And unfortunately, the public just, as a rule of thumb, tends to look at the information they're being given from these news sources and just accept it, because these are supposed to be the experts telling them the truth. And then we end up with a lot of the media outlets, either on purpose or unintentionally, most likely in most cases unintentionally, misleading the public. And then it just kind of snowballs into this quagmire of misconception. And
one of the other interesting things is that because there's so much money involved in technology and there are so many powerful, big players, I have the sense that, and it might not be that this is new necessarily, but I have the sense that because there's such an information gap in terms of how well people understand, like you're saying, the technological ramifications, the technical ramifications, the functional ramifications of legislating certain kinds of technology in various directions, that it becomes very easy for people to take a position based not so much on the technical issues involved, but on the money that's involved or the power that's involved. So the legislation is more often than not used to redistribute the balance of power in an industry rather than regulate the technology in a way that's sensible. The poker legislation, as an example, had all these carve-outs for certain types of conventional gambling to allow, you know, horse gambling and other types of conventional gambling, I think probably sports betting as well, but banned the novel types of gambling, namely online poker and particularly poker sites that were overseas. Does that ring true for you? Am I the only one that feels this way?
No, I think you're spot on with that. And you can see it at all levels of government. As an example, here in Colorado, gambling is against the law. But we have towns like Black Hawk and Cripple Creek where you can go up to the casinos and gamble. And then there's dog tracks and off-site betting places. Well, that's all gambling. What Colorado did was they changed the definition of gambling. And so those things aren't gambling, they're gaming. And it's all part of the political power money thing. So yes, you're going to see that everywhere. And it doesn't even have to be limited to the technology arena. Money, power, and politics, they'll take over anywhere they can, I guess.
All right, let's talk about money, power, and politics. Another show that we did on politics started off this way. Knock, knock, who's earning 15 cents an hour? There were two pretty emotionally fierce stories in 1 week that we talked about. Dave Hamilton came on the show, and I talked to him about this. Net neutrality, which Dave Hamilton was actually very wary of, the idea that people needed to be granted equal access to certain types of content, and that the content, the people that control the pipelines, namely telephone companies, Comcast, Time Warner, couldn't choose how to tier service. They couldn't say, you know, we're going to let this service be faster and we're going to make this service slower. That's the net neutrality bill. It got torpedoed on Capitol Hill. And the other big political story this year, iPod sweatshops. And this whole story about Apple's relationship with Chinese manufacturers and the fact that some of these manufacturers apparently had substandard working conditions. Apple launched an investigation. I'm curious your reaction to either or both of those stories, how you think they were handled, how you think The trajectory of those stories, because both of them are pretty much wrapped up now. Net neutrality is not being discussed on national news anymore, and the iPod sweatshop thing seems to have disappeared out of the news. What do you think of how those stories were covered and where they ended up?
You know, both those stories were great for news coverage because there were so many emotions involved. So it makes for good news, at least if you're a news provider, because stories like that drive up your the percentage of viewers, listeners, or readers. So they love stuff like that. I'm glad that the whole net neutrality thing has kind of died away for now, because I really don't think that the proposed bills, the discussions, any of it really had much to do with protecting the internet, protecting the consumers. It really felt like the whole thing was a thinly veiled cover for divvying up control and power. And so I'm glad that's gone for now. And if we ever need to have some type of legislation for that, fine, we'll deal with that down the road. And hooray for now, we don't have to worry about it. The whole sweatshop thing, well, that was kind of a fun little mess, especially the way it started out with Foxconn, the company that was manufacturing the iPods in question, saying, oh no, this certainly isn't happening in our factory. And then all of a sudden we have the abrupt face where they go, well, maybe a little bit. And then Apple does their investigation. I think Apple actually handled that very well. Apple has shown this year that they can be very graceful under pressure, because there has been more than one instance where they could have walked away with a black eye or egg on their face. And I think they've done a very good job of taking the straight and narrow on all of these potentially sticky issues.
I suspect that the other story that you're thinking of is the one about stock options. In both the case with the sweatshop and the stock options stories, Apple was, and we have talked about this on the show, very good at taking the moral high ground early on and turning what is obviously a problem, what is ostensibly an issue for the company, and turning it into a PR victory where they say, hey, look how open and how honest we are and the quality of business that we do. And they've clearly done a very good job of that. Now, on the show where we were talking about Apple doing PR victory laps on stories that were supposed to be a liability for them, this was from back in August, we also did a story where we said there's this Lionsgate executive talking about doing a movie distribution deal with iTunes. And then about a month and a half later, the iTunes store, or the iTunes music store, was renovated and became the iTunes store and suddenly had movies available. Lionsgate Entertainment's films are not on the iTunes music store.
Yeah, how about that?
How about that? We've got Disney movies there. The story with movies on iTunes is not developing in the same way as the story about TV shows on iTunes. A little over a year ago, Apple put television shows on the iTunes music store. And within 6 months, essentially all of the networks have fallen in line and posted their stuff for sale through the iTunes store. That has not happened with movies. And we talked about this recently, but is this, where are we in the trajectory of this story? Where are we in the middle? Are we still at the very beginning of this? Could anything happen? Or is it pretty clear how this is going to wind up?
I think we have some surprises in store, just more in the soap opera style of surprises, not in like the big bombshells of, oh my God, the store's going away, or nothing like that. But I think that we will have the different movie studios eventually fall in line, and they'll be providing movies through the iTunes store. It's a logical thing for them to do, because that's the online legitimate download source that has the best reputation, the best track record, and is generating the most revenue. So yes, they will sign on. I think that over the last few months, some of the under the table things have been slowly surfacing, where we've been getting a taste of the commercial politics that have been going on. You know, things like Walmart not wanting to have movies on the iTunes store or other download services, Target joining into the whole mix and wanting to have the same or better pricing than you get on the iTunes store. And, you know, when I look at that, I'm thinking, you know what, people, get a clue. We are not dealing with the same technology anymore, and it doesn't cost the same to take a movie and put it online for download as it does to manufacture a disc, all the packaging, ship it to a store, and then sell it.
And of course, include all of that additional content, all of the behind the scenes stuff and the 12 different languages and the four different sound formats. The other part of this that I always hammer away at is the issue with the fact that the movie industry has a much broader array of distribution channels than the music industry, and indeed than the TV industry. The movie industry has the opportunity, has the luxury of sitting back and saying, you know what, we're making plenty of money. If people want to get to these movies, they can get to them, and they probably hear about all of the movies that they're going to want to see because we're really good at doing our marketing. So you know what? We don't feel that strongly about it. It will be very interesting, and it was particularly interesting to hear Disney announce that they had sold whatever it was. It was $50 million worth of movies or something in the first month or so.
Yeah.
I may have gotten that number wrong, but I believe it was in that ballpark.
Yeah, it was millions. I remember that. It was a lot of money.
All right. Now, but I will say, if I were to step back and characterize the overarching story about iTunes, incidentally, I'm realizing that we've kind of split up the news of the year into two halves. There's the Mac part, which was this transition to Intel, and then there's the whole iPod iTunes story, which is its own story. And the overarching narrative there, as far as I can tell, appears to be the story of Apple's expanding reach in media distribution. And that's, I mean, it's a good thing for Apple. They've made a tremendous amount of money doing that. But it's also come with a number of very interesting problems. For example, the fact that the movie industry and the music industry and even the television industry are wary of Apple and their stranglehold on digital distribution. Because, like we always say, they're the only people who are doing it well and selling a lot of content doing it.
Yes.
So, given all of that, I mean, is there, obviously, you can only expand your reach so far, and then eventually you have total control. How far is Apple from that position of total control? And is their level of control over media distribution right now a positive thing or a negative thing for consumers?
You know, Apple does have a lot of control over the media distribution right now. But I don't think they have as much control as some of the distribution companies and even some of the news outlets would like us to believe. Keep in mind that we're talking about, even though there's lots of money involved, still a sliver of the whole distribution market, because we still have all the traditional channels, which, even though they're not doing as well as they have been in the past, are still raking in buttloads of money. So there's a lot of room to grow in the market that Apple is dominant in right now. And I think they will, for quite a while, have a very strong position in that market. But we're going to see some other strong players too. And I have a feeling that they're going to come from areas that right now people aren't focusing on. Like maybe we might see a consortium of the movie distributors coming up with their own system or something like that.
All right. Now, just in the interest of time, I'm going to point out a couple of other things. We won't linger on them for too long, but some other stuff that we discussed over the course of the year, and again, all of this is linked in the show notes. In one of our stories, one of our shows on media distribution, I think this was last March, or maybe, this was, so I think, yeah, last March, we did a show where we speculated about iTunes showing up on planes, and that essentially materialized last month.
Yes.
And we also, in that show, talked about pornography and whether or not it would ever show up in the iTunes music store, which was kind of an interesting thing. And speaking of this expanding reach that Apple has, I think one of the indicators that they do have a rapidly expanding reach and that a lot of people are starting to pay very close attention to it was this whole story that developed in the middle of the year about this French law that was going to require Apple and the other firms that sold DRM-protected media to open up those formats to one another. That seemed to be very much focused on Apple and its strategy of closing iTunes and the iPod and keeping them only working with one another. That seems to me to be yet another indication of their expanding reach. No one would bother to force them or to try to force them to open up their standard if, in fact, they didn't have any significant control over that marketplace.
Yes, and isn't it amazing how competitors, when they can't get what they want by producing a quality product, will try and get what they want by legislating their competition out of business, or at least into a weaker position. And I think that's a lot of what was going on here. We had companies that were lobbying governments, and they were picking the governments very specifically that they wanted to lobby so that they could try and push through legislation that would, in essence, hobble Apple's control over that part of the market. And if you look back at how this evolved, back to the beginning phases, when we first had the iTunes music store opening with the copy protected music, that was, you know, the first real viable option in that market. And it evolved because the music industry wanted to have copy protection built into the music, not so much because Apple insisted on it. And so here we are with Apple being hammered over conditions that the music industry put onto them. So in a sense, there's a little bit of irony there. But in the end, at the risk of upsetting some of our listeners, in true French fashion, they took what was a deplorable law, and instead of saying, oh, let's just scrap this and do something right, they found a way to change it and say, see, we're still doing the right thing.
Of course, that never happens in American politics. We always lousy bills and say, no, we don't think that's reasonable.
That's one of the great things about this country. We know that they will never enact any ludicrous legislation. So, you know, huzzah for that.
Right, exactly.
I'm sorry, I kept a straight face as long as I could.
The one other thing that I want to point out, I believe that one of the big stories this year was the product that wasn't. This also has to do with, so much of Apple's relationship to the industry and the nature, the experience of following Mac News and iPod News has to do with speculation. They are intimately tied together. It would just be market analysis if it were any other company, because it wouldn't be speculation so much as just looking at the, you know, vendor contracts that they had and asking the people who were working in the company. Obviously, none of that works with Apple because everything is so locked down in terms of their product plans. This was months and months and months ago, sometime in the middle of last year. I did a show where I talked about Apple putting real games on the iPod. And Apple recently released, when they released the movies for download at the iTunes store, at the same time they released games that you could download to play on the newest models of iPods.
Good call, Ricky.
And the now it was not my idea that they might be doing that. There was this executive that they had hired, who I think had worked at LucasArts Entertainment, and it was known that he had gotten picked up by Apple. So people were saying, hey, they're looking to do something. Maybe they're going to release a new product that's a game device. And so there was all this discussion about that, and that was the subject for the show. But what I argue was, you know, you could say, sure, Apple's looking to compete with Sony and Nintendo, but my intuition was that this was part of it was kind of a stepping stone to all this discussion about an iPhone. And to me, the one of the big stories of the year is the conspicuously absent iPhone. The fact that there has been constant and escalating speculation about this product, that it continues to not be released. It seems increasingly likely that Apple has been working on it, that they have found suppliers, that they've prototyped different kinds of products, that there has been real buzz and discussion in the industry about this product, and that Apple simply has decided for whatever reason to not release it or to delay its release.
And that's assuming, Jeff, that they're even working on an iPhone at all.
Right, and I suppose you could also make the argument, maybe this is all just an elaborate runaround. It wouldn't be that surprising, I suppose, if Apple set up contracts or made agreements with some of their subcontractors, with their vendors, to essentially place disinformation in the market to make everyone think, oh, we're doing all of these other things, just to keep people on their toes, keep people looking in the wrong places. But I'm curious what you think about my reasoning, Jeff. This is the idea. This is the argument that I laid out in this other show. What I was saying was, let's imagine that Apple continues to improve the music playing performance, that eventually the iPod becomes a great way to watch movies, that they improve, perhaps, the ability to look at your calendar or look at your contacts, that they streamline that syncing process, all of which is fairly straightforward. Particularly from a hardware standpoint, you don't need new hardware. It's all there already. And then in addition to that, they begin to build games. So they make it kind of, they increase the likelihood that if someone wants to do something, they're going to pull out their iPod to do it. And then at some point along the way, they say, well, hey, now all we're going to do is we're going to put an antenna in it. We're going to put a little speaker and a little microphone in it, and we're going to give you cell phone service. And so they take this device that already does all of the things, it's already a smartphone in essence, and they just say, hey, now we're going to go ahead and plug it into this this overriding cell network and you can make calls. It seems like, in a sense, like a classic Apple maneuver, that they, rather than try to release this revolutionary product, they keep releasing incremental feature upgrades and calling those upgrades revolutionary.
Sure.
That feels to me like the conventional Apple behavior. I'm curious if that makes any sense to you.
It does. And based on everything that we've seen over this past year, I think that the likelihood that the fabled Apple iPhone will become the actual Apple iPhone in the near future is pretty good. But I will add a bit of caution to that, which is when you look at the trail of evidence that's been cropping up over the last year, especially a lot of these patent applications that are appearing and a lot of the leaked information that's coming out of Taiwan and other places that would be manufacturing either components or full products for Apple, you know, there's a lot of stuff that when you put it together, you can say, okay, we've got some type of Apple phone product on the way. But keep in mind, that's something we all really want to see. So when we're looking at all of these patents and other bits of information that are coming out, keep in mind that all of these technologies would be equally useful in other products that Apple could manufacture. And that could be anything from a tablet computer to new features we haven't conceptualized yet for a laptop computer, another type of handheld device, maybe a modular iPod of sorts. There's a lot of other things that all of this could be used in. But I still think that we might have some type of communication device coming down the pipe soon.
And of course, the in a sense, the most overarching wet blanket that you can throw out is you can say, hey, all of these patent applications, all of these distribution deals, or all of these vendor deals that people have been humming about, you could also make the argument that all of them are simply deals for making new iPods.
Absolutely.
All right, and that is going to have to be the last word on this particular context machine. Hope you all enjoyed this this roundup of the year, year in review. And yeah, that's going to have to be it. Let us know if you think that there are other big stories from this year that we should have talked about. We might bring them up in future shows and mention that these are on your list. That's what we think is the big deal from this year. If you have another opinion, or even if you just want to tell us more about our own opinion, send it to roundup@macobserver.com.
Okay, and now that we've lived through all the exciting stories for another year, or in this case, our first year, I think it's time to dive into the product roundup. And of course, we'll start off with a quick look at mics, because that's what we've been doing lately.
That's right. And this week, you might notice that I sound rather different. That's because I'm talking into a dynamic mic again this week for the first time in quite a while. I've been talking into a lot of condensers recently. This is a Behringer Ultra Voice XM8500. That's the name of the microphone. And you may remember that when I first talked about a mic, the mic that I have been using, it's called an SM58. It's made by Shure. It's this classic rock star mic, a handheld dynamic mic. Right now I've got it held in a mic clip. But the Shure product is, depending on where you buy it from, anywhere from about $70 to $100. It's an industry standard microphone. All kinds of people use it for all different kinds of applications. We had a comment from one of the listeners after I reviewed that mic and then got onto a condenser, and he said, you just don't sound as good on that SM58 as you do on the condenser mics. And he said, you sound clearer, mo better, I think was what he said on the condenser. I sounded better on that. Well, I'm back on a dynamic. I'm curious what you guys think about this. And I'll go back and listen to them side by side, some of the early shows from, say, August, and compare it to the sound of this. These are supposed to be pretty comparable mics. The thing that's extraordinary about this Behringer is that it costs, wait for it, $30.
Wow.
So this is, it's a fantastic deal for a microphone. I read a little bit about it and looked around just to see what other people had to say about it. People love this microphone, and you cannot beat the price. So it's very interesting, and I'm going to, again, take a listen to what I did. But that's the mic I'm using, the Behringer XM8500 for $30, dynamic cardioid mic. And the only thing that I can object to about it so far is that the mic clip that it ships with is a little cheesy, I think, but otherwise it seems to work just fine.
Cool. And I actually reviewed the New Look Navigator this week.
Yeah, we were talking about this a little while ago, and in fact, I think you had, we got a letter in from a listener.
Yes.
Quite a while ago.
Yes, and actually that's exactly why I reviewed this product. So go read the review, but the nickel rundown is it rocks, it's fantastic, and it's designed for people using Adobe Creative Suite 2 applications, but it's amazingly useful in all other aspects of working and navigating through your Mac as well. So it's a great all-around product, and not just for designers.
Cool. And I also wanted to mention a couple of weeks ago we did our holiday buyer's guide, and I was saying, hey, I'm going to post this this headphone buyer's guide. Dave Hamilton and I have split up all this work to go and review a huge pile of in-ear headphones. And I did all the universal fits. Dave is going to do the custom fit models, and that will go up in the next little while. We posted that universal fit guide on in-ear headphones, and I am pooped out. It was a lot of stuff to write about.
You know, Ricky, actually, I had the pleasure of editing that story for you.
I'm so sorry.
No, actually, it was a pleasure. And I'm not just saying that because you're recording this.
Yeah, that's right. I could just cut you out of the show. Everyone could hear my half of the show.
Yeah, or you could apply some filter to my voice. Yeah, everyone that's interested in learning a little bit more about in-the-ear headphones, even if you're not planning on buying some in the near future, go read that. It's amazing the amount of information that Ricky packed in there, and I learned so much that I never even realized I didn't know about headphones and headphone technology.
More than you ever thought you could know or wanted to know about headphones.
Indeed.
I also wanted to mention, this is actually kind of cool. So one of the headphone, in-ear headphone manufacturers that's out there is this company called Ultimate Ears. And they have always focused traditionally on live performance headphones. They do a lot of custom fit stuff. And like I said, Dave is going to review their stuff. But I'm actually, this show, I'm monitoring this show as I'm recording with the set of their UE7 Pro headphones. And again, I'll link to that in the show notes. It's fantastic. I've never had, this is a very bizarre experience. I'll describe this to you very briefly, Jeff. I don't know if you have any idea how they make custom headphones, but they squeeze this goop in your ear.
Yes.
And then they pull the stuff out and you send them to the headphone manufacturer, and they build the bulb of the headphone to fit exactly in your ear. And it is quite an unusual experience getting these things back and slipping them in your ear. And Ultimate Ears, again, if you go and read the stuff I wrote about them, they do make terrific products along with the other manufacturers out there. And there are a lot of different choices if you want different sounds, if you are looking to use your headphones for various different things, like if you exercise or if you, for me, one of the most interesting things is that you can actually get headphones that are really good enough to do professional audio mixing. I mean, they make professional sound systems that fit inside of your ears. And because you don't need to pay, you know, to have these speakers mounted and to have the room treated so that it has the right acoustic properties, you can pay a few $100 and get essentially tens of thousands of dollars of quality and sound. It's amazing.
Isn't technology a beautiful thing?
Beautiful thing.
Okay, and that's the news. Thanks for listening to Apple Weekly Report.
That's right, and our content, even though the show name is different, is written by the fine people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is still by Boom, 4TMO, and that is all I've got.
Please stay subscribed.
And until next week, everyone, we'll see you online. Thanks for listening all this year. We'll keep it up if you keep it up. Cheers.